Before we start, I wanted to introduce to the commission Michael Brown, who will be replacing Rick Matsumoto of OIT. His appointment has not yet come through, so he will not be sitting on the commission today.
Well, Michael, I think you should feel free to take part in the discussion.
Yes. Yes. So, Stephen, let me know when we're good to go.
We're all set.
Oh, okay. All right, well, why don't we go ahead and get started? This is a meeting of the Colorado Voter Access and Modernized Elections Commission. It is August 15th, and we are in the Aspen Room at the Secretary of State's office. Why don't we go ahead and have the commissioners introduce themselves, since I think there are a couple of new folks. Richard, why don't we start with you?
Start on my side?
Yeah.
Good afternoon. I'm Richard Westfall with Hale Westfall.
I think you're Mike.
Okay. Sorry. Richard Westfall, the law firm of Hale Westfall. I'm the appointee of the Colorado Republican Party.
Hillary Howell, Boulder County Clerk and Recorder, here on behalf of the Colorado Clerks Association.
Hi, Elena Nunez, Colorado Common Cause, one of the voting rights advocates.
Martha Tierney, appointee of the Colorado Democratic Party.
State Representative Dickie Lee Hollinghorse, I'm substituting for Max Tyler.
Jason Syme with America Votes.
Marilyn Marks, substituting for Representative Bob Rankin today.
Jennifer Levin, the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People, representing people with disabilities.
Suzanne Steyert, representing Secretary Gessler.
Great. Well, why don't we go ahead and get started? The first item on our agenda, as always, is public comment. Is there anyone who wishes to offer public comment today? Okay. Then let's move on to the update from the technology group on the development of the web app for voter service and polling centers.
Thank you. Thank you, Commission. My name is Trevor Timmons. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Colorado Secretary of State's office. And so the project on the voter service and polling center app falls under my domain. Just to level set, again, maybe for those of you who are newer members of the commission, the intent of this voter service and polling center is to support all activities required under 1303 at VSPCs, save adding new voters, right, or changing the name of an existing voter or updating a driver's license of an existing voter. That functionality counties will, as they have in years past, they would use the core score application to actually perform those activities, but everything else they can pretty much do through that VSPC app that we've been developing. And I'll get to the plan on phase two on VSPC. I'll give you an update on that as well, that version of the application that will support adding new voters through that web app. So the development and the testing has gone pretty well. We moved into user acceptance testing on Monday, August 4th. We had about a dozen counties that chose to participate in that, as well as staff within our office. In the application, through that 2 weeks of testing that we've just concluded yesterday, we had 8 items that failed testing. None of those were critical functionality items, and only one of those was actually discovered in the second week. Most of those items, 7 of those failed items were discovered in the first week of testing. All of those were patched last night in a patch that we released last night. We're expecting some of the UAT counties will be able to devote some time to testing those patched items today, and then over this weekend, obviously our own team is doing that as well. We did have one substantive item that we saw in the UAT cycle that was not patched last night. That has to do with, we had 2 users that reported when they, as they're going through the VSPC, when they want to print a barcode to actually attach to a card to actually move on to voting, you know, barcode just indicating which ballot should be provided to that voter. When it popped up that PDF window, it wasn't actually showing it in display mode, preview mode. It was actually popping up a dialogue saying, do you want to save this little PDF label? We had 2 users report that. We think it's actually a Windows registry setting. We haven't figured out exactly which registry setting that's associated with. Again, that's not a critical item. You could save that little label and then open it as a PDF. We did gain approval from the UAT test counties yesterday to actually move that version of ESPC forward for the mock election, which starts next week. We've been doing some third-party security and performance testing of the VSPC app. The phase one of the security testing was completed yesterday. Mitigations for all those findings from phase one, they were included in that patch release yesterday. Most of them were vulnerabilities that are not accessible if you weren't an authenticated user. So like someone outside of the state network who didn't actually have an account, an election judge account with a login and a password, they wouldn't be able to exercise those vulnerabilities at all. We did go ahead and remediate those vulnerabilities nonetheless. We did provide, I mentioned we released a patch last night. The code review of that latest version of code, we expect to see that on Tuesday from that third-party security company. On the performance testing side, we've had good results so far. This past Tuesday, we had a performance test. We actually ramped it up to about 2,000 users over the course of 2 hours and 20 minutes. We're revising our test harness a little bit to reduce the number of address changes that test harness was actually generating. It was producing address change transactions for almost all of the voter activities. That's much higher than we actually expect to see. We're going to be re-executing performance tests this coming Tuesday as well. Those of you that have been tracking this, we're tracking five major risks with the project. The first is distributed denial of service attacks. That's one of these attacks from groups such as Anonymous, where they leverage, a bunch of robot computers to generate a lot of traffic to a website. We've been collecting IP addresses from counties. We're creating defensive firewall rules that we could put in place if we saw this type of attack. And then we also have alerts in place if we see IP addresses coming into the system that we haven't already seen before from county locations. The second major risk is timeline challenges to the development. Our passage through UAT actually augurs very well for this. We don't think that this is a significant risk anymore. Improper or weak security controls is the third risk. We did provide guidance to counties this summer on how they can address those. We're extending a checklist that counties can use as they're setting up machines for use in VSPCs. And then we have also offered this Apex anti-malware software that counties can use to prevent malware-based attacks. More than half of the counties in the state have actually accepted this offer and are installing this Apex software. The fourth risk is a lost or stolen device with sensitive data, with voter data. The VSPC app doesn't actually store any data locally, so it's not really a risk from the VSPC side. We are asking counties with any devices that they're using in VSPCs that they encrypt any portable devices, that the hard drive is encrypted, that they're password protected. We've already provided that sort of guidance. And then the fifth risk is really around resource turnover and retention. It's not really much of a risk now. We have retained the staff, the contract staff that have been doing the work for us, but we actually, that risk again, because we're pretty much done with the software development side, that's not really much of a realistic risk any longer. On the other items, VSPC Phase 2, as I mentioned, adding that add a new voter functionality. We did collect requirements around that in some joint application development sessions with counties. We'll send those requirements out by the end of August, just within a couple of weeks. We are doing some prototyping, kind of some wireframe design work already on that, and so we'll probably send some pieces of those screenshots out when we send those requirements out to counties. In terms of Citrix licenses for full score access, our usage pattern in the primary this year, it pretty much mirrored the usage that we saw in 2010 in that primary. Less than 700 actual full Citrix users at peak during that primary. That's the same thing we saw in 2014. So we're preparing for a usage pattern that's similar to what we saw in 2010 during the general. We reached 1,350 users during that general election. We will obtain loaner licenses and pull servers into the farm to support 1,500 to 1,600 full-use Citrix users. That's above that cap that we saw. We're also doing some work with a web-based lookup that we've provided to designated election officials so that counties such as Denver could maybe leverage that within their call centers. Instead of using a full score Citrix user session, they could actually leverage just a web-based lookup to answer questions from voters. And then the last thing, just to kind of increase our reach to counties, we've held these quarterly security webinars. We actually had some earlier this week. We're trying to reach out not only to the election staff in counties, but also to their IT support staff behind them and actually advise them on some of the things that we're seeing in terms of risks, you know, the availability of this Apex anti-malware software and that sort of thing. We actually had 60 participants earlier this week. That's up about 50% from the last quarter. And that just allows us to add more information about those IT support contacts, you know, to our stable of folks that we can reach out to as we're moving along. Those are the major items that I wanted to cover. Kind of covered where we are in VSPC development, kind of phase two, where we're going with that. You know, our preparation for full Citrix licenses this fall, as well as addressing those five major risks that we've been tracking for several months.
Great. Are there any questions for Trevor? Martha?
Thank you, Trevor, for that update. It sounds like the project is moving along really well, and I was very encouraged by your, that risk has been minimized or is gone over and over and over, so thanks for that. One question I had, and I wonder if it's coming up next week in the mock election, is what kinds of things are we doing in terms of guidance or best practices to mitigate any loss of connectivity? So will there be, for example, hotspot emergency air cards or whatever we might be out there in the marketplace to ensure that should we have a loss of connectivity in one spot or greater area that we've got a way to continue?
Sure. Again, Trevor Timmons, Secretary of State's office. That's actually more of a county responsibility to make sure that they've got MiFi cards, that they've got alternate means of actually accessing internet. From the score perspective, the centralized data centers, you know, two balanced data centers, we've actually mitigated that risk in terms of having two different connections, right, through two different ISPs. One is through the state-managed, you know, CenturyLink network, and one is through another ISP. I know I've mentioned to the commission in past meetings, we actually did have an outage at a state routing point in the election in 2012. And you didn't actually read about that in the paper because that mitigation we put in place early in 2012 allowed counties that were operational to immediately route to the other data center and actually continue activities. We do know, just from past experience, some counties are going to have individual sites where they're going to have issues. Mm-hmm. If they can't validate, if they can't verify, you know, eligibility and the fact that someone has not voted when they walk in, then they're actually going to move back to issue provisional ballots, you know, until they can resume that connectivity. Most counties don't want to do that, right? That's why they obtain these MiFi cards, because they can plug those things in. They can connect over a cell network, you know, to internet and get to score, get to the VSPC app, and go ahead and do that verification right there. Is that responsive to you?
It does. Thank you.
Okay.
Other questions for Trevor? So I have one. You talked about under the denial of service risk that there were defensive firewall rules that could be in place if needed. How does that work? If there's an attack, then the rules go into effect, or as it gets closer, you make a judgment about whether or not to put those rules in place, or is it just going to happen? I was a little confused there.
Sure. So what you do essentially any computer can get to the front door of the voter service and polling center application. I mean, if you know the URL, you can get to the front door. To actually get beyond that, you've got to have a login, you've got to have a password, and you have to have a grid card. You know, it's a two-factor authentication. So you have to have a login, a password, you know, and then you have to type in a response to this little challenge code, right, that the website throws at you. That's what you need to do to get to VSPC. Distributed denial of service attacks, they generally try to overload that front door, right? So the computers that are showing you that front door, that very first page, they're getting so many requests from so many computers all over the place that they get overwhelmed, okay? So what we're doing is we're tracking all those computers from which counties are actually legitimately accessing voter service and polling center. We're adding those to a firewall rule, and it's essentially allow no one unless they're on this special list of people that I know about, okay? We can create that firewall rule and have that ready to throw into place if we see this sort of DDoS attack. We're not going to put it in place. We're going to have it ready to flip the switch. And realistically, when you flip the switch, it blocks everyone else. It denies those nefarious attacks to actually get to that front door, and it'll only allow legitimate traffic through.
So the rule, to kind of carry out the metaphor, the rule is like a gate in front of the front door, and you only put the gate up if you have to, but it's immediate, so there's no delay if it looks like that's required.
So immediate, several seconds,
right.
But yeah.
Great. Okay, thanks. Hillary, did you have a question?
I did, and I don't know if this is the place where could you talk just a little bit about the mock election and what that process is going to be looking like? Is that... don't know who's in charge of which parts of those as I look out to the crowd as well.
Sure.
A joint effort, but.
No. Again, Trevor Timmons, Secretary of State's office. So the mock election is actually run by the folks out of our SCORE customer support unit. For the most part, these are elections professionals. They're not IT geeks,
okay.
Right? So they've put together kind of the script of activities. The intent of a mock election, going back to 2008, when we started running, mock elections as kind of a best practice, is to have counties pretty much execute every step that's required when they're actually running a real election, right? It serves a couple of purposes. It allows us to flush out any, application bugs, any problems with training materials or checklists or process maps that counties may use, whether we provided them or whether it's county information that they've generated themselves. So it allows us to make sure that all the process steps are kind of laid out and that the application supports them, okay? The second thing it does is kind of a training exercise. So the counties who don't run elections, every Monday, every Tuesday when they walk in the office, it allows them to familiarize themselves again with all those steps that are required using this software application to actually run an election. So we found that it's not only good to make sure that the software does what it's supposed to do, but it's also good, training for folks who maybe haven't done it in a couple of years, maybe haven't done it in a year, or maybe folks have just recently been hired and they've never actually gone through it before. So it really serves two purposes. That is run out of that SCORE customer support unit.
I knew they were running it. I was still just with the org chart of, okay, where does that go to? So because I know some of it...
Right.
I'm with you now. Thanks. I appreciate it. And I just thought the overview would be good for the commission to understand that the mock election was coming and how we follow up with that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Jennifer?
Jennifer with the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People. I was just wondering, since you mentioned the mock elections, will there be people testing the accessibility of the machinery and making sure certain disabilities will be accommodated?
So again, Trevor Timmons, Secretary of State. So when we conduct a mock election, we make sure that counties can execute all the steps that are required as they're using SCORE and VSPC. We don't require that counties actually go to the actual act of voting to verify the accessibility of a voting device. That's really what we're trying to make sure is that all those all those areas within the conduct of elections that interface with voter registration, that, you know, that they're well-trained, well-equipped to do those. And so from the accessibility side, no non-election judge actually interfaces with a device during the course of a mock election. Now, with the VSPC app, absolutely. We've done accessibility testing on that web-based front end to make sure that, you know, people who are colorblind can still actually note, you know, the things that are of interest, that people that couldn't hear a bell, you know, a chime, that there's still a visual representation. So we've done that sort of accessibility preparation of the VSPC app. But we don't actually move down, and I'm not positive that your question is directed at the accessibility of voting devices. Is that what it's directed at?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so that's kind of outside the scope of a mock election exercise.
Okay. Thanks.
That's usually taken care of in your setup and preparation and testing of the equipment. And then you take it all the way through the whole process after ballots designed to make sure that the audio matches up, all the buttons work as well. So there's a couple phases of testing of equipment.
Great. Any other questions for Trevor about the web app or anything else technology? All right. Thanks so much, Trevor.
Thank you.
So our next agenda item is an update from the Business Practices Group.
Thanks. This is Hillary. We have a couple phases of this. The first part we're going to start with is Amber McReynolds is here from Denver to talk about some of the data collection they've done. And the purpose of it is, one is to hear about that process and then also to give us some ideas, as we talked about by the end of our September meeting or September early October meeting, having a real a plan of what it is we want to see from this election in order to evaluate it. So this is to give more information in those lines and go from there.
Okay, so in our last business, or actually the last few business practices group meetings, we've been talking about data as it relates to the election process, the voters' experience, the operational aspects, and sort of what counties collect on that. We have a fairly sophisticated system for data collection. We've had it in place since 2008 for the voter hotline side of things, and then from the operational side since 2009. So we've got a lot of data over many elections that we've been tracking, and so today I'm gonna sort of share some analysis of that data in terms of how we have collected it in the hopes that possibly we can look at doing some of these things statewide. So first, our Denver Elections Operational Support System consists of three different areas. We have a voter hotline, and that is essentially the city's main phone bank type line that calls go into from voters specifically. We also have a VSPC hotline, and that's our operational hotline internally that's only available to election judges, field staff, anybody that's actually working in the election. And then we have a communications hotline that we give to media, candidates, campaigns, poll watchers, any of those types of folks, that, and they can reach our office directly that way. So the two hotlines that we're going to talk about today are the voter hotline and VSPC hotline. The voter hotline uses the city's 311 system, and that is a centralized phone bank that takes calls for the entire city. It has a CRM system which manages all the case components of each call. Every call and inquiry is documented, and response time is tracked. So we have metrics that shows how long it takes our office to respond to a call that possibly gets transferred, or, as an example, an agent to actually respond to a call. It's a centralized call center. We have data since 2008 in that system. Our VSPC hotline is our operational hotline, and that uses a system called WebEOC, and it's the city's emergency management system for Denver. And actually, I was talking to the WebEOC coordinator for Denver, and he actually, I think, said that most counties in the state have the same system for emergency purposes. So we've coordinated with them, and we're able to use it for election tracking purposes, so it might be a good fit for other counties to use this for elections as well. We can track all calls and entries. It provides us analytical data and metrics post-election. We also can use it for emergency response type situations. So if there is some sort of large event citywide or an event that happens at a particular location, we can actually blast out from this system to all the emergency responders in the city, and they can effectively respond if needed. So we can use it for multi-purposes. It also tracks the purpose, subject, time, date, location, team assigned, resolution, and how long it takes to resolve the call as well. So this is a summary of the voter hotline. And this goes back to 2008 general, but you can see on the top, we took over 57,000 calls in the 2008 general election from voters. And what that amounts to, I actually compared it to the number of votes cast. So basically, one in five voters that cast a ballot in the 2008 general had to call our office to get information. And it mostly related to, in looking at the reasons why, voting locations, because we were polling places, and that was primarily the way that people had to go and vote. PMIV was new in 2008, so we had a lot of calls about how to become a permanent mail-in voter. We also had a lot of calls about voter registration. That's sort of always been a very high volume call for us. You can see that changes over time. And in particular, in the 2010 general, we went down to 8,200 calls, and that was 24 votes cast per call. And the biggest reason for that is a system that we put in place beginning in 2009 called Ballot Trace. So our number one call in 2008 had to do with getting a mail ballot, permanent mail-in requests, when is my ballot going to arrive, did you send it, did you get it, did it get counted, all of those things. So we looked at that data and said, how can we proactively communicate that to our voters so that they don't have to call us to ask us for it? So we created Ballot Trace in 2009, and primarily the large change from 2008 to 2010 came as a result of Ballot Trace. You can also see in the 2012 general, we had about 20,000 calls. Because we did Ballot Trace, the number of calls about mail ballots actually decreased, although we still had a good volume because all of the elections in between the 10 and the 12 general were conducted by mail, so voters made an assumption they were going to get a ballot. So we got a lot of calls from people that weren't on PMIV as part of that 20,000, but a lot had to do with voting locations, voter registration, all of that. So our rate got better, three times as better as 2008, so we were at 15 votes cast per call contacted to our office. And then you look at sort of the 2013-2014 primary, and I have a few more slides to sort of make some comparisons amongst primaries because it is a very comparable metric given that the 2010 primary, 2012 primary, and 2014 primary were all conducted as mail ballot elections. So they're sort of good comparisons in terms of the types of call volume that we would get in an election. And this slide here shows first call resolution. So we look at this and track this very closely because when a call comes into our city, our main city hotline, we want that call to be reserved or resolved on the first point of contact. We don't want the call to have to be transferred. So the rates have fluctuated, and there's been a lot of different reasons for that, but we very much look at this and want to make sure that those calls can be handled on the front line, and we adjust training, we adjust quick code, resolution guides, all of that to accommodate that. You can see in the 2014 primary, we were up between Sunday and Tuesday, election day, we were up to a 92% resolution rate, meaning that a voter called our hotline in the city, they were able to get answers to their questions 92% of the time based on the first contact they made. Average over the election is 74%, but I do want to point out on the average for the first call resolution for the election overall, that includes a 30-day window. We serve campaign finance filings at the local level, and there's lots of other categories that may be in there. So the Sunday to Tuesday sort of column is very specific to election day and sort of the very close time period around election day. So we have all of this, and we also have within this first call resolution based on the type of call that they made. So mail ballots or voter registration or voting locations, we actually have rates all the way drilled down into those particular categories. And then the voter hotline analysis, this compares the last three primary elections, and there's a couple trends that have occurred. First, the first call resolution rate that is at the bottom of the screen, that's based on the slide that we just talked about. You can see in the 2010 primary, it was 44%. 2012 got slightly better at 45, and then 2014 at 74%. And in looking at that data, the primary reason that you see an increase in the first call resolution rate and also a decrease in the total calls that came in for the primary is a change in the number of voter registration calls that we received. So in voter registration calls in particular, from 2012 to 2014, we saw an 85% reduction in the number of calls that we received from voters with voter registration questions. And that, to us, tells us a lot about the voter registration process, it being simpler, easier for them to understand. When we look at 2008 or we look at 2010, primarily the reasons that we got calls for a primary had to do with, you know, I just moved into Denver, what do? I didn't meet the 30-day, or how do I change my party affiliation, or how do I do some of these types of actions? 85% reduction in calls specifically about voter registration is significant from a 2012 primary to a 2014 primary. We also saw a reduction from 2010 to 2014 overall, a 73% reduction in calls, primarily because of ballot trace. More people were familiar with the process. It was easier to change their addresses through OLVR. We anticipate that probably played a role, given that it's from 2010 to 2014. And then from 12 to 14, we saw a total reduction of 40% in total calls, but we had an increase in turnout. So we serviced more voters in 2014, but we had less calls coming into the hotline. So for our operational hotline, we call it our VSPC hotline. We use our WebEOC system, and it monitors and tracks. It responds, gives us an ability to evaluate, adjust, and plan. And on the screen, I've got an example. It's kind of hard to see, but this is a sort of example of a case record. We use the existing emergency management system. We create what we call an incident, meaning the election is the incident. It's specific to our office. We can load in all of our location information, phone numbers, any information about a particular site, information about the operational hotline takers. So their information all auto-populates. They don't have to retype a lot of this. They focus on the description and then the type or the category of the call coming in. So this is how we basically track all of our operational field requests, calls from judges, what have you, and we categorize everything into a certain number of categories, and then we track all of that analytically over time. And this gives us a really nice ability to not only monitor what's going on in the field and respond effectively, but going forward in future elections, adjust training manuals, adjust training procedures. If we think that a site is struggling from, you know, whatever perspective, we can send out a field rep to do some on-the-site retraining. We respond to this with supplies. If they need more supplies, they call in. Everything is tracked in this system through the hotline. We started using this system only having calls coming in, so the judges were trained to actually physically pick up the phone and call. Now we actually give iPads to all of our supervisors, and we've done that since 2012, and they can email in non-critical issues. So like if someone, an election judge, didn't punch out for the day, or if they, you know, need more pencils but it's a non-critical supply, they can sort of email some of those things in and reserve the calls and the phone calls to specific issues related to the voter or elevated type issues where they need to talk to our office. And this next slide shows a summary. So this is a list of resolved items from the most recent primary. Each case is assigned a unique case number, so if we need to go back and refer to anything, we can do that easily. The actions taken, so if we assign this, say, to voter records and a specialist within the voter records team, they document the actions that they took, they document the advice that they gave to a particular location, then in the event that the, you know, a similar call happens, or if we can track things over time, we can notify supervisors and say, hey, we understand this issue is happening, here's the resolution, and we can track it effectively. We also, by exporting all of this data out of the system after, this is also how we adjust training materials in the future if we can see trends of certain issues being elevated. So we also have this is our WebEOC entries by date. So we can track basically by day, and we have metrics that shows the number of entries. And this, again, is calls and iPad emails coming in. We also can track per 15-minute interval. So in a given day and over time, we can track all of the calls and the types of calls that we get and look for any trends that we might expect to see. You see at 10 o'clock and at 6 o'clock, we have a spike. Those are opening and closing times. So we use the iPads to the supervisors will send us an email about 10 minutes before open to say everything's up and running, the computers are all on, the DREs are set up, the site is ready for opening. If we don't receive that email, we're on the phone with them within about 60 seconds saying, why aren't you ready to open yet? We also do that same procedure at the end of the night, so we have them notify us via email that they are ready to close and the last voter has voted and they've started their documentation reconciliation process at the end of the night. They do all of that. If we don't hear from them within 15 minutes of closing time, we'll call and make sure that they're good. We also have data. These are the calls per 15-minute interval, so this eliminates the iPad, and it does show different spikes. We can track those spikes to, as Trevor mentioned earlier, score outages or, you know, some sort of issue like that. In the event that something like that happens, this system gives us an ability to be able to jump on that issue right away, allocate additional resources, or kick in our contingency process, including MiFi cards, or actually getting physically on the phone and helping the judges process voters if we need to. This shows actually there was a sort of score blitz in the primary election on the 21st. It was actually right before opening, so it sort of happened right at 10. There were no voters affected, but we were able to, within about 2 minutes, get all of our operators on the phone with every one of the sites to make sure that they were up and running. In the event that they wouldn't have been, we would have been able to continue processing voters and checking information if needed. They were also allocating and describing the procedures and making sure the judges were comfortable with that right away. And then election day calls. We also can track by the different day, and usually when we've looked at this over time, this is from the primary election, but if you look back at general presidential elections or gubernatorial, with the previous model, we would see a huge spike in call volume on election day. So the opening, the closing, usually midday, there was these huge volume spikes. So we would adjust our hotline staffing based on those types of trends. It's leveling out slightly with the sort of revised model, but we'll be tracking this very closely in the upcoming general to see if that maintains the same for, given that we have more VSPCs open. And then by category. So not only do we track everything by day, by time, 15-minute interval, what have you, we track by the types of calls that we get. So over the last several elections since pretty much 2010 when we started using this system, voter registration reasons for contacting the hotline have always been the highest. So this is our operational. This is the election judge calling with questions about how to do something in SCORE, how to vote somebody in the module, how to change an address, how to do any of the functions that they need to do. And it has always been, it's been pretty steady at about 40%. And, you know, we've looked at this for the past few years, and that was primarily why we made the recommendation through Business Practices Group to make some modifications in the system, in the SCORE system. And then the state, you know, they've done web SCORE, and we anticipate that this percentage is going to go down significantly because it's going to be a lot easier for the judges to process information in the system and process voters. Voting sites, computer equipment, election judges, those have all remained fairly steady over time, but, you know, again, the voter registration one is always our largest. And within the voter registration, the various reasons that they do call us A voter needs hotline assistance. So the election judge is processing a voter, and they need to get an answer to something right away. That might be why. They forgot training. That is a big one. And, you walk by our hotline, and you hear them saying, page 18. Remember when we talked about page 18 in training, or reference your quick guide, whatever it is. So they can easily do that. They're trained in the same way that the judges are in the field, so they can easily respond to all of that very quickly. A registration judge error, so if they incorrectly pull up the wrong record and issue credit, or if they need to spoil a ballot for some reason, those make up just under 30%. Dymo label printers, these are the little label printers that produce the barcodes. Everyone hates the Dymo label printers, but they only in this last election made up 3% of the calls. So that's a big improvement, because normally it's higher than that. Customer service suggestions, we also get a few calls, so the judges might call us and share a suggestion from the voter that they might have. And then WebEOC by site. So this, we look at this very closely over each election, and if you see the lowest number of calls we got was from Harvey Park, which is the one designated as HP, and that was our most experienced supervisor. The highest number of calls that we got was from our first-time supervisor at DPD-3. Not a bad thing. It's just that stays fairly steady. So we do know that, some of the folks that have returned from election to election or worked more recently, we tend to get less calls from them because they're more comfortable with the material. We do track this because if we do see a site that is trending pretty high for calls, we may send out a field representative or someone from the office to provide additional training and assistance to that particular site. But we look at this very closely over time and make sure that everybody remains fairly similar in terms of the calls that we receive. And then what do we do with all this information? So this is really only a glimpse of the information that we have. There's a lot of detail that's behind a lot of this data. And so we do quite a few things with it. Number one, for our VSPC hotline, we use it to project staff that we'll need to cover the hotline. So we put a lot of different contingencies in place to make sure that we've got staff to cover the calls coming in or the emails coming in from the sites operationally. We also look at adjusting training materials. So if we see trends of certain questions coming up or the judges not being able to handle something correctly, we will adjust our training materials for the next election or immediately if we see that it's a trend during the election. We also adjust voter materials. So if we got a lot of questions about how to mark the ballot or how to fill out the affidavit or whatever, we might adjust, the instructions we provide on the envelope or the instructions we provide to the voter. So there's lots of ways that we utilize this information over time. And thus, sort of the conclusion for this particular presentation, this sort of data analysis is truly great for effective planning and preparation, but it also directly connects the voter's experience with policy and process changes. So the voter registration changes and the number of calls coming in likely has a big impact when it comes to the policy, and then similarly to the process. So online voter registration came in. We saw a decline in the number of voters calling about how to fill out the paper form or how to change their address. It also directly connects operational changes and efficiencies with policy or process changes. And then it also allows us to continuously improve all of our processes, and it also gives us an ability to proactively communicate with the voter, hence our ballot trace system and some of those things that have provided direct correlation to their implementation time frame versus previous elections. So with that, that's it. Tried to make it pretty brief and not too much in the weeds, but there's a lot of detail in here.
Any questions, Richard?
I have a request and a question. The request is, could you provide us the PowerPoint for the members of the commission?
Yeah, we have it. We'll send
He's
it
got
out.
It. Great.
Thanks. And the question is, do you have some sense, or does somebody like Hillary, do you have a sense for how many other counties would have done something similar to this kind of analysis?
So just to be clear, Denver is the whatever high-end car version analogy we want to use, and that's why we're bringing it to the group, is, and the resources and the volume, like when does it make sense? I would say some of the larger counties may have something similar, but not this sophisticated from the sampling that we've done. On business practice group, the Denver was really the only county on that group that had this level of review, and that's why we were discussing it at business practice group with the goal from this commission is, how do we make it the right level of collection for the results we're trying to produce with the resources that are available to the different counties? And to show, I mean, at the high end, what is possible, again, and then when does that make sense? And so that's why we had Amber show that to everyone.
And the voter hotline one is the city's 311 system, so I don't think there's any other county that kind of has like a centralized for the county. But the WebEOC system is the one that might be the most viable from the operational side, because I think there's a state contract. Trevor might know. I think there's a state contract on for WebEOC because the state uses it, like the state of Colorado, not necessarily the Secretary of State's office, but the state of Colorado does. Mm-hmm. And I think they have a contract, and I think that most counties are on that or have access to using that for emergency purposes. Because it, for the city, it's the emergency management system. We just use it, and there's no cost to us. We use it free from the city based on their current contract, and it's simply adding on to already existing functionality. So I think that one's probably the most viable for getting other counties on that type of system, tracking this type of data.
And we just learned that at the business practice group, and as the business practice group, there were counties were very excited about that. And again, no one was thinking about 2014, to be clear. We're having the conversation far enough ahead so that we really can get a long run at it for counties to implement. And then short term, what are some other things that we can collect, maybe not in quite as elegant of a format, but I know for our county, for instance, we will be getting more detail on what types of calls, what the volume is, as opposed to, I mean, you track it and you get a good sense, but it's nice to have actual data as opposed to impression, as we all know. So those are sort of the things that, for the commission, I'd like us to discuss is, you know, what does that look like? What's interest to the commission? And then as a business practice group, what's realistic? Do we have some counties pilot the collection? Those are that are more motivated. You know, do we have some counties try some different methods so that then when, you know, when we look at what we want statewide, we have some knowledge behind it as well. Those are the types of questions that we have. So,
Amber, can you, given that Denver is so big, if we try to get our hands around how much staff time, let's take that as an example for a metric, is there a way to sort of break it down by, so we had this many staff and we had this many voters and a percentage of voters, we had this many calls, and maybe that's a way to look at. So if you had this many voters, you can expect, I know not, it's not going to translate exactly, but it might be a way to sort of look at how other counties on different scales might need to allocate resources to try something like this.
Yeah, and so like in the primary election, we primarily had one person on the operational hotline servicing the voter service and polling centers, and he handled everything effectively. We had a backup to him in the event that he needed more. We also had a contingency. Should we have multiple sites go down, we'd have people on the phones that could handle it. But we primarily staffed it with one operational person that provided the support to the field. In the general election in 2012, I believe on election day, we had 12 to 14 people handling the volume on that particular call center. And then for the voter hotline itself, in 2008, with the 57,000 calls, I believe that between the city's 311 system and then the additional phone bank that we had at our office, we had upwards of 60-some people on the calls. But then in 2012, with the huge decrease, you know, a 37th, and it was more than cut in half, I think we were no more than 20. So it's gone. It keeps going down significantly, and I think at this point we've projected no more than 10 will cover those calls in the 311 center, and we anticipate, you know, probably around 10,000 calls or so this year, which shouldn't be a huge, huge thing for us to handle. So, yeah, we have that. I mean, we can drill that down as well.
And I just want to clarify, most counties have some form of call center, just to make sure that's clear. It's and have ways that they collect the data. It's just not all using the web EOC. And the fact that so many counties have that access to them, large and small, that's what's kind of exciting about it, is because then it can be more uniform. And so just to make sure, if any of the other counties are out there, I want to make sure they do an awesome job at answering and having all the call lines as well and staffing them. And that's also to get where some other numbers, you know, can look at other counties of how many calls do you get and what's your staffing, what's your turnout.
And we also, the web EOC system, the communications hotline that we have, it also goes through that VSPC hotline. So if we get, like in 12, we were, you know, in contact a lot with various poll watchers or candidates, campaigns, different things like that, party attorneys. They called us, you know, would call in any issue. We would record it in there, and then our communications team would also track those issues all the way through. If they needed to go to legal or whatever, we would get them involved as necessary. But really what it does is it creates sort of that historical, you know, perspective of what you looked at, and you can track all the way through. And then from, you know, the Canvas perspective or what have you, we've gone into WebEOC and said, you know, this didn't make sense. What happened with this incident log? And we go in and we can easily see, here's how this was resolved. Here's why this should be this way as opposed to this way. So it's a great tool in that way as well.
Other questions? So questions for Amber. So then the next part, and maybe this is just to give us thought, because again, really by at our September, early October, whenever that meeting gets scheduled, to be thinking about what do we want to try. But I would be curious to take a couple minutes of, you know, what did you hear that was interesting to you, so that then I can take it back to the business practice group and they can start thinking of, like, well, what are ways that we can manage to collect some information that also, you know, doesn't require, you know, four extra staff, or what are we already doing that we can add a little bit onto. So I think that's good for you, Amber, and then that's my question to you all. what did you hear?
Anyone have thoughts?
Well,
Richard?
Yes, this is Richard. I certainly thought at least this much information was extremely useful. And I guess if I had one more question for Amber, and it would be, if I understood Hillary's comments correctly, the idea was that you would be sort of the exemplar, if you will, to sort of show what kind of data collection could be done, to give us some sense for what kind of information could be gathered during this last primary election. I'd like to know, I guess a question I have for you is, how difficult was this for you? How much extra effort did it require for you to put the data that you did put together in the presentation? Because I found the presentation was useful. I found it informative. It gave me some insight as to how the processes worked this last election, and I'd at least like this much data, and I want to know how difficult it was for you to gather that.
Well, for us, not difficult, because we can export a lot of the sort of totals and the data out of our existing systems, and we've been tracking this over time as well, so the kind of the historical comparisons, that kind of thing. I mean, the presentation itself, I mean, I tried to kind of pull out trends and pull out things that I thought would be, you know, interesting for the group to look at as an example. And I think that the biggest piece is the that at least we could do going forward for counties is, if they're not using a system, at least how are they tracking? So at least tracking, you know, the category of the call. So is it a voter registration call? Is it a mail ballot call? Is it a voting locations call? Is it something else, kind of thing? So at least sort of defining the major categories would probably be a start, because we've refined those over time a little bit, but there's kind of the big categories. There's registration, there's mail ballot information, voting location, how to fill out the ballot, you know, those kinds of things. So I think there's definitely some ways that we could put some things in place, at least for the general, to track some of that. And counties may have some of this available from the primary. I can't speak to if they aren't using some sort of system. I don't know exactly how difficult it would be to pull together, but I would imagine that counties would have at least, and maybe we can make it sort of high level or general, you know, from the category perspective, or at least the total number of calls, or, you know, things like that, to at least start somewhere. We could probably look at that.
Okay.
And then I guess the one other question that I have for you is there something out there that were issues or concerns in the primary election that would have been a problem, however broadly you want to define the word problem, that would not have been captured in what you just presented to us?
No. So we, out of the 60, I think we had about 62,000 votes cast. We had 1,000 calls, which, I mean, that's a very, very small percentage compared to what we've received previously. And we've seen, you know, saw the significant reduction from the 12 primary to this primary, even though, you know, there were changes. So I think that definitely the trends tell us a lot. And then for the hotline and sort of the operational perspective, you know, what adjustments do you make? And a lot of the things that I suggest in business practices come straight from this type of data. You know, when we talked about like the, you know, web score and how that should look and some of that functionality to make things easier, it's all based on this data and the number of registration errors that we see done by the judges or the number of calls we get about the voter registration process. So, I mean, anytime you hear me say something as it relates to policy or a process change or what have you, it's likely based on this type of data, because I've never been one. If someone comes and says we're really busy on the phones, I say, don't tell me we're really busy. Come back with numbers. Come back with staff. Come back with how long it's taking you to, you know, process various people. So I'm very data driven in terms of process or procedure or policy recommendations that I make. So likely anything that I would conclude would come from this type of analysis.
Well, thank you for your presentation. Thank you for all the work you did, and thank you for your presentation to us here today. Thanks.
Okay. You're welcome.
So, Suzanne, am I understanding correct that we would be talking about not the collection for 2014?
So it's short term and long term is what it is, and the short term is what can be collected, and do we? I think at this point, with some, if we added additional requirements for this election, their heads would probably implode because of the anxiety around the web app, to be frank, and that should be there. I mean, we're changing a process quite a bit. I think there's other counties who would be willing, it's working with the willing, to collect some of the data, and both it would give us information on how hard was it, what resources did it take, and then it also could give us some early indicators for then what do we want to start looking for in 2015 and 2016, and can we work into using the web EOC, especially if counties already have it. At least that was a conversation with the business practice group. So hopefully that answered your question.
Well, I mean, I was just curious because, you know, by 2015, this commission won't exist anymore. And so, you know, I just wanted to limit the conversation to something that was relevant rather than the long-term planning aspect. But you know, what is the implementation of 1303? Not necessarily some of these other questions, which, while they're interesting, are not really on point to, you know, what we're talking about. You know, filling out a mail ballot, that didn't really change with the implementation of 1303. Those kinds of questions, I mean, I guess maybe we'd have a few more of them because we have more mail ballots out there, but that was just my concern, is getting into a, you know, some kind of huge project regarding, you know, what data collection is going to look like in 2016 isn't really going to do anything for this commission.
And if I can respond to that, part of what our charge was, though, was to determine what data we should collect to evaluate the model. And some of that was also leading towards what do we also collect in 2016, whether we're meeting as a commission or not. And so that's where the seeds of this are from.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think that short term, obviously, we're not going to see an implementation of a system like this, and that's not realistic. But I do think figuring out, is there a way to capture the types of issues that are coming in from voter service and polling centers? Because that's what the operational hotline or whatever, or the web EOC, whatever you call it, that's what it tells you. And it could be that it's training, and so that informs the sorts of, you know, training that needs to happen. It could be bugs with systems or processes, but it seems like that will give us a lot of information that's helpful in evaluating 2014. So thinking about if there are ways, maybe not as sophisticated as Denver does, but if there are ways to gather that information, that would be helpful. I think the other thing that would be useful to know that I think is harder to capture is on the voter experience side. I think the hotline is helpful to the extent that it identifies problems where voters are reaching out to counties. The other piece, which is difficult to measure, is are there places where there's stress on the system? So in the last 4 days, that's likely where you're going to see in-person turnout. Are there periods of time where really long-term that's where there needs to be an expansion of resources? Or, you know, are there other things we can learn from the voter experience? And I don't know that that gets captured through the hotline unless a voter calls and says, I'm annoyed, I'm waiting in line. So is there a way to track that as well? But I think that the Denver model teaches us a lot about how to see where there could be bugs or flaws either in the system or in, you know, training your processes, and figuring out how to expand that would be really helpful. So I think it's totally on point in the short term, even if we can't do it in that way. Anyone else? Madam Majority Leader?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm still a little confused between what we're planning to do short term and what we're planning to do long term. But let me just see if I've got this right. So you're planning on presenting at our perhaps September or October meeting, a list of things that are expected this year. Or are you already have that? Has that already been determined?
I'm hoping that list is coming from this group.
Okay.
Then we'll bounce them with business and some from business practice group for us to finalize. I mean, we talked a little bit about the survey. We asked for some data. That's my hope.
Okay.
But it's not
so that's not so the business practices group is looking for some guidance from us on what kinds of things should be. We should try to collect in 2014, and then in addition to that, obviously, this is a long-term process by which there are many other things that can be done. So that's something that those of us who are on the committee will have an assignment to come back with some suggestions on that. Is the business practices group going to talk about that? Are they going to develop some categories about what we might, what they think is, I think one of the things that's very important that we get from the business practices group is what is possible within the time frame? And what do they do now? What additional things do we think would be useful in analyzing how the election went and how we look at that? I think I'm sure there are a number of things that by rule county clerks and election systems have to keep track of, and I guess it would be useful to have that information, and then, you know, what are the other kinds, and we could talk about what are the other things that we think would be helpful that would be doable within the time frame.
Right, and so I guess I didn't do a setup as clearly as I thought. So we have done a lot of that conversation with our survey and the data that we've collected from that.
Right.
One area that we hadn't talked about is sort of this incoming call voter experience, and so that's another category to add to the list. Part of the rest of my report today is also I brought the questions that we asked in the last survey. I also brought what questions we wanted to add on with the goal of, if some of you looked more at the survey in between our meeting and this meeting, and then really if you haven't, then we need to get the survey set at our September meeting so that counties then can be prepared. I have a business practice group meeting already scheduled the 18th of September, so the goal would be to have our meeting after that so I can take back whatever you're saying, run it by them, get some ideas. How hard is it to generate? What do we already collect? Those are some of the questions we haven't asked as clearly. I'm going to definitely do that. What information do we already collect that's easy to share? Mm-hmm. Those sorts of things. We have a whole bunch of surveys that come from the Secretary of State's office. I don't know if we've looped some of that information in. This is really what we did with the survey was really kind of an addition, and a lot of the stuff is UOCAVA focused, some of the prescribed things, but that's, what are we already collecting? Again, to your point, what are we already collecting? What can we collect easily? What might be a stretch, but is worth collecting? That helps.
Yeah, so thank you. I think I get it now. And so the other thing I just wanted to bring up, I think the whole idea of using the emergency management system for this operation is brilliant and a wonderful lean government approach to doing business for the taxpayers. And so it would be something that I think we as legislators would want to kind of address, look at. If this is something that's easily transferred in most counties, then I think it's something that we definitely would want to see folks pursue. If there are roadblocks to that, And there might be in other jurisdictions and other areas. You know, it would be nice to know what those are and see if we can't make that a good example, because it really is, in my opinion, a terrific example of how you share across silos to do good work.
So next up on the business practice group report is we had a report back from conference and what were the major topics that are applicable to this committee. One topic was continues to be the implementation of the NCOA process. The changes with 161 in some ways have complicated it, and so what the business practice group is going to create either it will be all of the members or a subgroup. It's, again, the working with the willing to look at what are those real issues and then work with Secretary of State's office of how do we, you know, where can we streamline the process? What does rule, what does technology, and where are the parts that are making that sticky? So and when we'd like to then report back at the September meeting, at least with an update, and then hopefully go from there if that works for the committee. But that was one of the issues that came up. The other is one that we've already addressed and came up in the survey discussion last time is the hours and number of locations. We expected this, especially because our first, you know, we had a coordinated, and that's pretty small. We've done a primary, and that's pretty small. But again, we do want to get the formulas right. I mean, I think everyone wants to apply just the right amount of resources for the number of centers that we need to serve the population, and how do we continue to collect data to make those decisions? Some of the things that came up were, you know, Saturdays across the state and some of the data that you'll both see and then will be given to you, and we can talk again at our next meeting. We'll show you that Saturdays are really, really slow. So what do we do with that? Again, nothing. We're not changing anything now. It's just tracking the data. That was some of the conversation. The other thing that came up was some of the issue, and this is, I believe, in the recent rule proposal, is that reasonable business hours be defined as 8 hours. For some counties, that creates overtime situations for them because they have set up and closed down. And so a lot of them will be open 7 hours, with a half an hour to open and a half an hour to close, and that fits in the regular business hour time. And so that was just one of the issues that had been brought up. And that's for in general, even during the week. We hadn't defined reasonable business hours, and so people were trying to do it without overtime, especially in smaller counties. And I just think it's something as a commission we need to be aware of, because those are the costs there. And then another thing, just counties were talking about how they handled that they're closed on Fridays, right? And so that also impacts your overtime and your hourlies. So, again, I'm the messenger on bringing this to the commission. Then the last part was we talked about the web app and the mock election. Many of the counties were UAT counties, and everyone was extremely complimentary, Trevor and your team, of the really great work getting that web app. Everyone that was on the phone was so excited to use it, and just it's so much more intuitive and going to be so much easier to train too. And so that counties, I know, are really looking forward to trying to break it in the mock election. Oh, you know, using it properly, but putting it through its ringer in the mock election. And then we'll gather together counties as well to talk about the interaction of business processes and the web app, and we'll come back to this group at the next meeting and give an update on that, as well as I'm sure we'll have a technical version of that and perhaps the state version of that as well. So whatever you guys want. But I know the business practice group felt that we would be discussing that as well to bring items to you all. So then the last piece is to go one more round on our survey. I took out the answers and grouped them by color of like what groups of questions go together, because I think once you put in the answers, it kind of got pretty spread out. Oh, Richard. And so with this, there's a couple additions that aren't on here if you want to make a note. And again, this may be, you know, I don't know if we do anything with this now as opposed to just really like next time. I guess it's as you, I don't know if we take a minute and read it to see if anything immediately pops to head, because, again, I want to be able to bring any additional information to the business practice group to get a check-in from them of how hard it is to collect what you want. We could also do that through email. Again, that meeting is scheduled for the 18th, so there's plenty of time between now and then. There's three questions that we talked about last time that haven't been added in. This is literally the survey we handed out. Getting data collection on ballot returns by day and by location. We did talk to the business practice group, and many of the counties already have that information. So, again, that will be something we can add on to this to give us an indication of, you know, we have it at the macro level, like how many people are using 24-hour boxes, how many people are dropping off in person, how many people are mailing, how many people are voting in person. Those sorts of questions are woven in here. But breaking it out by day and location, we can also see patterns and trends. So, and then another question that we wanted to add on was how many stations are at each voter service and polling location? Because we have the total number and we've done some averages, but it is to get a sense of, you know, how are you staffing some of those? I think the challenge with that is how then to present that information back to you all, because, you know, some counties have 34 of them, and then some counties, you know, have 13, and it's still, so is there a way to aggregate some of that information, but otherwise it's, you know, you think the one from the primary was hard to follow. So that's one of the concerns. I mean, I think we still gather the information. I just don't know how we, looking for ideas on how we present it back to you all in a way that is digestible. So, and then the last item that we talked about was how to work with, you know, it can either be described as waits, or it can be as the busy periods, or what are the peaks. How do we make sure that we're capturing that in some way? Some of it you'll see a peak, but did that peak cause a line, right? Some of it's a peak, and yes, it was a line. And so, and then what's considered a reasonable amount of time? Because when you look at the work that I'm blanking on his name from MIT did on waits, Colorado has outs, you know, that's really not an issue for them. You look at the Pew report on that, and with that said, we still want to make sure that with our new model, are we still meeting those standards, and are we doing everything we can to serve the voters?
So, Hillary, one question that, and I don't know how to capture this, but it seems like something that wouldn't show up in the reports otherwise. One change from the primary to the general is that there's the web app and there's Citrix. And maybe it's implied with the stations, but the processing of, like, how are you splitting it up and how are you deciding who goes where and when? And I don't know if that's more of just getting feedback or if that's part of a survey, you know, a formal survey, but that might also influence some of the questions about peak performance and other things because, yeah, if a place, you know, had one line and you had to talk to the, you know, one person before you could go to either station, that would be a different experience than if you had someone working the line or whatever. So, figure out how to work that in.
Yeah, so it is that it's the some counties are using the mock to determine what model are they going to use. One of the things that did come out in our business practice group meeting is, you know, people are planning on loading their PCs with so that the, you know, whatever image they put on it has Citrix available if needed. Because again, you got to be able to flow. Like if you suddenly, I mean, for us, I think of my university site where they're the most confused and usually have the most registration issues. And so that's one of those where you want to be able to shift how you have people processing to meet the needs of the people that are there. And so that's not that everyone would be using Citrix licenses as their first choice because everybody's loving that web app. But you want to have it available. So those are the sorts of things that we're looking at. And then, you know, to your point, the more we can want those questions ahead of time, people can, you know, track it as they're heading in, and that's really why we want to have this nailed down September, early October, so when we go back and ask the groups, they kind of know it's coming and have put some processes in place for it. So, and I don't have an answer to that one yet, but we're thinking about it as well. If others have suggestions, please, how you measure that. Okay. Next month.
Yeah. I wanted to ask a question about undeliverables. I know we've got a section on here about under NCOA about how many undeliverables you have. Is there a way to break it down by? I'm wondering if one cause of undeliverable ballots is that voters are using a different address for mailing as opposed to residence. And is that worth tracking to figure out if there's a sticky point in there that is something we might be able to work on?
Like a voter education, like
yeah,
they put down this mailing address, but they really or they put down their physical address and, well, yeah, I have a mailing address, exactly. And I didn't write it down, or that sort of thing.
It seems to me that that would be helpful. And do we track that already? Like, if there's a, if the ballot is going to an address that's other than the residential address, and that's a reason for a bounce? Do we know?
No, I mean, we fixed that last year when we had that issue with mailing addresses and, you know, in the rural counties where you don't get mail at your house.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, I don't think it was a big problem in the metro, so it probably didn't get a lot of attention. But in the rural counties, that was an issue, and we fixed that in the NCOA this year.
Oh, yeah, I was wondering about if you meant just from a voter education standpoint.
Well, sort of both. I mean, so, I just think it's interesting from our perspective on how we can minimize that data point.
Now, let me take that back to the group and see. I know that, you know, you have the anecdotal issues where people come up. I think one of the patterns we saw, not to a great extent, was when someone entered a mailing address online, they didn't get that that was their mailing address, not just for that one election, but that's where their ballot was going. And so that was one of the things we captured to bring forward. But again, to the extent, you know, don't know on that, but that's.
And is that data that we already track, Suzanne? Do you know that?
Do we track
when? If a ballot was undeliverable and if the reason for, or where it went. So, like, it comes back undeliverable and it went to a mailing address that was different from a residential address, is that?
It just bounces back. Just, I mean, back.
Yeah. Right, but I'm saying, is there, that's not something we already track in?
No.
Okay.
There's not really a efficient method other than looking at each piece and why was it undeliverable. Usually those come up when the person comes in to the office and would be tracked, but maybe the. Is there more data?
Hey, Amber, I don't mean to interrupt you. Do you mind going to the mic so that we catch it in case anyone's listening?
No, I think out of score, I think you'd be able to pull out your undeliverables and then determine the percentage that were undeliverable that were sent to a residential address on file versus those sent to a mailing address. I think you to at least see if there's some sort of discrepancy, or is that kind of what you're asking?
Yeah, I think that would be really helpful data for us to have as a commission.
Because I know, like, we as undeliverables come in, we actually map them and then look at them by zip code, look at them by neighborhood, look at them by in various ways across town. My GIS guy calls it the lazy postman map. And to see if there's any trends so that we can reach out to the you know, post office and kind of say, well, what's the issue here? And we have actually identified issues where, you know, the normal postman's on vacation. And then certain pieces will, you know, come back or what have you. So we've identified those and then they redeliver or they will, you know, correct that. But, I mean, we can, I think within the data set you'd be able to determine the number of undeliverables that were at a mailing address and the number that were residential.
I wonder if the overlay on that, though, is the replacements, because some of them, because that's when you would know that it, some of them, they're just, like, the people aren't there any longer.
I would look at the total undeliverables, separating out any replacements or address changes, so what your final undeliverable was in the election as opposed to what all of them were, because things do get corrected, and then that becomes a, so I would only look at the, basically the final confirmation card mailing, because those, all the address issues were already resolved, so.
Okay, so is that something that business practices could get?
Do you think you can look at that by the 18th, and then we'll talk about it?
Yeah, we'll look at it in our county, and we'll see if it's feasible.
We just went down a data person, so I'll have to see what we can do.
Okay.
So we're hiring a good data person if anyone has anyone who needs.
Thanks.
Advertise everywhere. Thanks. Anything else on that jumps out? Oh, keep going,
So as we were talking about NCOA, my understanding is that different counties process on different timelines. So the statute now, everyone processes monthly, and there's not that period before the election, but some do it more frequently. It might be interesting to know when counties ran their last NCOA, as it influences the did it account for the changes in undeliverables and things like that.
This is
Jason with America Votes. Do we discuss from the last time about getting the number of provisional ballots?
Oh, actually, I have that.
Okay. And you do? Maybe I missed it. I was just...
No, it's not on here. And with it was so low, I can tell you it off the top of my head. So there were 20 provisional ballots statewide. 7 of them were accepted. And the majority reason were people's party affiliations after the party affiliation date. And then there were like, you know, of the 13 not accepted, there was like 10 of those. And then 3 were not eligible to vote in the state or district or county. So, and it's printed somewhere, and I'll send it to you around. We had a little.
And so we plan on doing the same tracking that we did before. Okay, just making sure.
Yeah, the state did a great job at providing a report for us, yeah.
Thank you.
Then thank them.
Thank you.
Dwight over there.
Do we have anything else on the data collection? Okay.
So again, just my request is if you look at this and you see questions ahead of time, please email them to me before the 18th. That way we can run them through the business practice group, especially if you think it's something more complex, then we can also talk with other groups of how hard their data is to collect. That would be much appreciated on that. And then the last part I have for the business practice group is some issues that we already talked about some of them, but what we'd like to present at our next meeting, the September, October, depending on when we get it scheduled. One thing, so we talked about coming back with a mock election and from the business practice group, so we'll bring a report back with that. Also setting the survey combined with finalizing what data we'd like to see. We'll also come back with an NCOA report. And then another thing that we'd like to bring to the group is there's a group working on the with the post office on post issues. And so they've been doing a lot of really hard work, and Amanda in Denver's office has been helping co-chair that, and then the Secretary of State's office has also been involved with that. And so we thought it would be great to bring that back. The business practice group would like to have that group come and speak to you about those items. Yeah. As we head in, might be a little late, but they're working very proactively on it. So, and that's the business practice group.
Great. So that brings us to the end of our agenda. We need to set our next meeting after September 18th. Well, there's data collection for the general. Anything that we didn't cover that we should?
We have the data that we asked for, and I think if we pop it up really quick, the only advantage of seeing that is just to show you some totals at the bottom that really kind of matched what we saw in the coordinated about what types of changes were being made, how many new registrations were, and some volume. Again, if I can just show you some totals today and then have you take that with you, and then is that going to meet our needs for 14? And if you just scroll down to the bottom of them and do issued ballot instead of no ballot data. I think it's like row 10,000 something, 97 or something like that. I've looked at it a few times. There we go. So these are people who actually were issued a ballot. Can you magnify it one for those who don't want to put on their glasses? We have room on the screen.
Oh, that's nice.
This is why I never wear my glasses, because thank God for technology. So you can see the new registrants who were issued a ballot, again, it was 382 across the state, and that's throughout the election. For the September, we'll bring it to you by election day. My data person was out who converted this for me last time, and I apparently didn't pay close enough attention on how they did it, because I can't remember. So then updated within the county, again, this is what we saw in the coordinated. We saw, again, the greatest number was, once again, within a county, the moves within a county. And then, again, across the state, again, even lower than the new registrants on that. So, and again, you guys have all the... If people have logic questions, I'll send that around when we send out the data. The Secretary of State's office did a great job of, you know, here's what we did to look at this and here's how those are. Then we also wanted to show no ballot. Can you click on the next one for me? Thanks. Because, and then if you scroll to the bottom. Because one of the unique things with the primary is people registering as unaffiliateds, they won't be issued a ballot. And so we still had a lot of registration information going on. So when we make, you know, Suzanne made this point at our last meeting, when it's like looking at the whole volume of what's going on at VSPC, not just who voted, and to make our conclusions.
And so people actually came in to register knowing they voted.
So some, if as we got closer, and again, I'm going to break this out so we can see it by day. in a different view. But that's our next level of investigation, is how many of these were actually done in the office, which would just be registration forms coming through because of the new law, and then how many were actually happening in the center. Again, to get a real perspective of what's going on in a voter service and polling center. And then there's one more chart, which is shows some of the volume at the so then it's vote by count by method. So this, again, if you scroll down to the bottom, and again, we'll send these around for you all to look at. So here's the total number of people who, the first column, unfortunately the header's not up there, is the DRE voting, and then the in-person paper ballot, flat ballot. Yeah.
Sorry.
You're doing awesome, Stephen, then. It's like very good with around the corner. Yeah. But so the first one is DRE. The next one is paper or flat ballots, mail, and then provisional. Yeah. Oh, yeah. However they send them around, and who they send them to, and they'll be posted obviously as part of the as a meeting on the site. And again, then there you see the 7 accepted provisionals. And that's also, if you're looking at it by county, when you see ballots accepted after Election Day, that also represents the provisionals. And they were so low at first, it took us a while. It's like, what are these? It was like, those are. And then for the total turnout for the state. And so then if I get these done ahead of time, I'll send them around to you, but to show statewide by date as well, but using the pivot tables, as I'm sure many in this room could have done in about 10 seconds. But So this is the data that we've collected so far. Again, if we can, you know, take a review of what we collected in the coordinated, what we collected in the primary, and does that meet our needs in combination with the survey so that we can really land on that information for the counties early in September, late September, early October.
Fine. That's all I have. So, Hillary, I've got a question about the in-county updates, which was the largest group under the ballot issued. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to break out, were those changes that were made through NCOA, they were made because the voter initiated, is there any way to know? Because that's one where, under the law, if the NCOA had caught it, it would be done automatically. So does that just capture, does that include those changes, or was this something done outside of that process?
These are changes that, registration changes that had to happen in order for them to vote. So any of the NCOA would have been, they would have already gotten the ballot. It could be, like, they had an update from NCOA as well. That we wouldn't know. All we would know from this is that however their record was in SCORE was not how it needed to be for them to participate in this election.
So if they – so they either didn't show up as part of the NCOA list, or the timing was off such that they were on a list after the ballot was issued, and then there had to be additional action to get the right ballot to them. Okay.
Does that sound right?
So that, for the in-person voters, what the query obtained was the type of registration, new registration, registration within county, registration within the state, and the registrant voted in person, which means that that transaction happened all at once. So in... I'm really having a hard time imagining that any of those were NCOA related. I think they were probably all voter initiated at a voter service and polling center.
So then
because they issue the ballot and they have to vote that ballot before they leave the VSPC.
Right. But then that actually raises a different question, which is that if these aren't, if it wasn't that a mail ballot was sent out, then it seems like the number of, and I think Suzanne raised this at the last meeting, the number of in-person transactions is artificially low if you look at the vote by method, because there were 11,000 voters who changed an address within their county, but only 4,000 who voted. If you look at it, looked like they voted in person because everything is linked into mail. So
so that's why we need to look at it by day, right? Because one of the things that you need to see is when did VSPCs open and what were the pre-numbers, right? And then once the VSPCs opened, we continue to process registrations in our office, and so that's the next layer. And we've been talking about how do you show that of So you get what happened in the VSBC and what was part of just your regular registration. And primaries are also abnormal because we're, you know, we're, a lot of people are registering for the general, right? They're just blowing by the primary. And so that adds to the to the complexity. But we do, to figure it out.
It feels like there's another layer. Yeah, yeah, and exactly. It's just, I'll be interested because it feels like there's the in-county updates. It feels like there's something interesting there, whether it's about in-person voting or people who are, you know, falling through the NCOA cracks, and it could just be a timing issue if there was a blackout before, but I'm not sure. It just seems like there's a lot of action going on that will tell us something about how voters are
interacting. It is. It's like, why is that? What are those about?
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yes. So I think, unless there are other questions about this last chart, our last item is just to schedule our next meeting.
And again, my request is after the 18th of September.
And do you want sometime after that to pull things? So not the 26th,
So like the week of, late after the 24th of September, sometime in that week would work great, or later. That gives me a few days to process and prepare to, and, you know, run the election. Details.
So if we stick with the Friday, the 26th, the 3rd, do either of those dates work better for people?
26th
looks great. We're talking the 26th of September?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So does the
3rd? I think I'm out of town. But I'm out of town on the 26th.
How about the 3rd? That work?
I think I'm in town on the 3rd.
Okay. And does the noon time still work?
Works for me.
All right. So then why don't we pencil that in, and then we can check with Representative Rankin and Suzanne and Fran and see if that works as well. But in the meantime, mark your calendars.
Okay.
And 3 at noon. Okay. Anything else for today? All right. We're adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you, and thanks.